From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn why more labor unions are forming in Wisconsin and throughout the country. Then, as colleges work to enroll more underrepresented students, some local universities are pledging free tuition.
For students from low-income backgrounds, what this means is that more barriers will be removed. We know that cost is a huge factor for making decisions on where to go to college.
Plus, we'll tell you about an app-based walking tour that highlights indigenous landmarks in Milwaukee.
And the purpose of the whole project is to just highlight how indigenous community members in Milwaukee have shaped Milwaukee, you know, not just in the past, but right now.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. More unions are forming across the country and right here in Milwaukee, from workers at Colectivo Coffee and the Pabst Theater Group, to corporations like Starbucks and Amazon. Laborers are using their collective power. John Haywood is a UW-Milwaukee Distinguished Professor of Economics and the director of the Graduate Program in Human Resources and Labor Relations. He joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang to dive into why unions are having a moment and if this trend will last.
Across the country, and especially in Milwaukee, we're seeing what seems like a resurgence of labor organizing, from local businesses like Colectivo Coffee to the Pabst Theater Group workers, to even national chains like Starbucks and Amazon. It just seems like there's an increase of union presence in the city and in the country. Why are unions coming back?
Well, first, Mallory, I think you're right. I mean, organized labor is having a moment, whether it's going to be a large moment that changes the future or not, we'll have to see. I think there are sort of two parts to this labor moment. One is increased militancy by existing unions. I've got a list here of 20 major strikes that have happened recently. You're probably aware there's a very large strike by nurses in Minnesota. It's the largest private sector strike by nurses. Here in Milwaukee, or at least down in Racine, we have a strike at Case New Holland. So a lot of strikes. We just avoided a strike in the railroads, as you know. So part of it is increased militancy by existing unions. And the other, as you correctly point out, Mallory, is that there's a resurgence in organizing itself, which is the process of trying to start a union. And the latest data from the NLRB suggests a substantial increase in the last 6 months. And that's happened in large portions of the economy.
Right now, at this stage of the pandemic that we're at, and we've experienced the pandemic for the last 2 years, what kinds of factors are coming into play here that are pushing more workers, more laborers to want to unionize?
I think that there are really three major causes for this moment of labor, as I'm calling it. One of the causes is the pandemic, as you suggest. I think it did a lot to show what I'll call front of the office or frontline workers that their jobs were tougher than they were before. And not only were their jobs tougher than they were before, but they saw many of the white collar and management employees go home to work, which if you're trying to be a nurse or you're trying to get food out to people, you just can't do. COVID, I think, is part of it. I think another thing that's crucial is that the economy is at a particularly advantageous point for workers to try to improve their working conditions. We have very low unemployment, and the share of all adults that's working, we call that the labor force participation rate, is also low. So both of these combine to have many, many employers needing workers that they're having trouble finding. And the consequence of that is that workers know they're in a more advantageous position to push for improving the workplace. So I think that together with COVID are two of the major causes. And the third one I'd mention is that the current administration is more supportive to unions than the previous one. And this means that the National Labor Relations Board is more favorable. This means that the president will get on the phone and talk to the governor of California about labor relations and trying to improve them in a way that certainly wouldn't have happened before.
With this resurgence of labor unions and just talking briefly about what has happened in the past, what factors came into play that might have stifled union organizing in the past?
Well, there we go. First, let's put it in a little bit of context. About 10.3% of wage and salary workers are union members currently. In 1983, that was well above 20. So, you know, since the 80s, we've lost, you know, half the share of unionization. And part of that has been the decline in traditionally unionized industries. But the other part is that that decline hasn't been made up by successful organization of the growing industries. And those growing industries are, among others, tech and retail. And so what we're seeing is some of those starting to try to unionize. And it's hard to unionize in the United States. It can take a year to get a first contract, or you might never get a first contract. The problem from the union's point of view in getting to the first contract, organizing getting to the first contract, is that American attitudes, American managerial attitudes toward unions, I think, have turned decisively negative over the last two or three decades. And so they tend to view unionization really as a managerial failure. I couldn't organize, I couldn't manage well enough to keep the union out. And so they fight the union. And they do that in both legal and illegal ways. And the labor law is such that the penalties for unfair labor practices by firms are fairly modest, so they continue to do that.
And of course, John, you also focus on the relationships between laborers and employers too. So I'm just curious too, the talking and thinking about the opposition from employers and from managers and not wanting unions. Is there a shift in that relationship as more people are more interested in labor unions?
Well, we'll see, Mallory. It's hard to make a good guess what's going to happen to the relations. I mean, I'll say a couple of things that are important for understanding the background. Most Americans routinely say they favor the objectives of what unions are after and see unions favorably. The most recent numbers from the Gallup poll, they do an annual Labor Day poll, was that 3/4 of Americans support unions as an ideal and something that they think is an important part of the United States. But that doesn't mean that every worker in every circumstance wants a union for themselves. So that's one important point. The other important point is that there's a huge diversity of potential relationships between labor and management. We routinely are able to find exemplars of cooperative labor management relations. And when that can happen, there's a potential to have win-wins in which workers' working environment is improved and managers are able to learn more about what their workers can teach them about what might be happening on the shop floor or in the restaurant or anywhere else. And so in those circumstances, we have some employers who are not resistant to unions. But by and large, as I say, the pattern over the last few decades has been greater resistance.
And how could this upward trend of people, you know, feeling more favorably towards labor unions, an increase of labor unions in the country, in Milwaukee, really, how could this trend affect workers in the long run? And are unions here to stay here in Milwaukee?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think two points are critical. One is you know, we've seen this long-term decline in the share of the workforce that's unionized, and that's been punctuated in Wisconsin by Act 10, which did a lot to diminish the prevalence and power of public sector unions, and also by the change by which Wisconsin became a right-to-work state. So that had at least as much to do with private sector unions and allowed individual people who are covered by a union contract to not join the union and so support it. The point is that these things have led to this decline, and it's probably a little premature to say, wow, we're going to sort of grow back the unionization that we've lost. Well, Wisconsin has been one of the states, because of these two relatively recent changes, to see the largest decline in unionization. So that doesn't mean we shouldn't think that things could turn around, but it would be just that, a big turnaround.
Thank you so much, John, for being here on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you being here today.
Goodness, Mallory, it's been my pleasure.
John Haywood is a UW-Milwaukee Distinguished Professor of Economics and the Director of the Graduate Program in Human Resources and Labor Relations. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. Wisconsin students from low or moderate income backgrounds will have more access to tuition-free college next fall. The UW system is expanding a tuition promise program that started in Madison to other campuses, including Milwaukee. It promises free tuition for Wisconsin students whose family income is under $62,000. Carthage College in Kenosha announced a similar free tuition program called the Carthage Commitment. These programs come at a time when college enrollment, especially among low-income students, is declining in Wisconsin, partially because of concerns over affordability. WUWM education reporter Emily Files is joined by college access advocate Kevin Curley. He is senior program director at College Possible Milwaukee, which helps students in 19 Milwaukee high schools apply to and stay enrolled in college.
You know, there has been a growing trend in private universities to also offer programs like this. Lakeland University in Sheboygan County was the first, I believe, private university to offer a tuition promise program, and it's very generous as well. Lakeland is also a higher ed partner of ours. MATC, they also have a promise program that's been in existence for a short while that offers to do similar things. So this has just been welcome news to have the UW system covered by this. But what Carthage is doing is also excellent, especially in southeastern Wisconsin, having one of the flagship private universities in southeastern Wisconsin offer generous support for students in tuition and making sure that the out-of-pocket cost for tuition at least is as close to zero as possible.
So what does it mean for the students that College Possible serves to have these new tuition promise programs available starting next fall?
Absolutely. It means a lot for our students. College Possible serves students from low-income backgrounds. And what we've noticed is that over the past few decades, the cost of college has risen significantly. And that is the cost has gone up both in the public university system, but as well as in the private university system. And so for students from low-income backgrounds, what this means is that more barriers will be removed. We know that cost is a huge factor for all families who are making decisions on where to go to college. But in particular, for low-income families, cost is an increasing barrier. The federal grants haven't kept up with the rising cost of tuition. It's great to see that we had a record increase in the Pell Grant, but the Pell Grant still doesn't cover, even if you were to get the entire Pell Grant, meaning that your family, your expected family contribution is $0, that still wouldn't cover the cost of tuition at many of our UW schools and certainly at our private universities.
You know, thinking about the Bucky's Promise program that started at UW-Madison, I think in 2017 or 2018, Did College Possible see an increase in the number of students who were going to Madison because of that program, because it has such a clear message of you will not have to pay for tuition if you have a family income under this amount?
For sure. These kind of programs are attractive to our students because it reduces their out-of-pocket costs. And UW-Madison is one of the top schools where our students attend. And what I'm particularly excited for is UW-Milwaukee being covered, because that's our largest school where our students attend. And tuition there is over $8,000 for students. So this will certainly help students in our local community and help them afford college and take on less student debt. What we do know is that the cost of college falls disproportionately on students from low-income backgrounds. And what we know about our society is that typically means students of color. And what we know is that students who are Black, Indigenous people of color are more likely to take out student loans and take out larger student loans to cover the full cost of college. So this will help our students have fewer out-of-pocket costs.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because UW-Milwaukee is such a common choice for students who are graduating from Milwaukee high schools. So thinking about the impact that this program is going to have on their college costs, it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're still waiting on more information about exactly how this program will work. What's really encouraging about this program is that students will automatically be considered when they fill out their FAFSA. And in Milwaukee Public Schools, the FAFSA is now going to be a graduation requirement this year. So a lot of students are going to be able to see how much they're going to benefit from this program. And so there's a lot of exciting changes on the college access front, particularly in Milwaukee. You know, for these first couple of weeks, we're just welcoming back and getting our sessions up and running, getting our coaches in the building. But once financial aid season kicks off after October 1st, that's when the FAFSA becomes available. I imagine we'll start to learn a lot more about this program and programs like it.
Tell me a little bit more about your reaction to the Carthage program. One thing that is different about that one is that it also takes into account Stafford loans. So students will potentially need to take out loans to have their full tuition covered.
What Carthage is doing is absolutely huge. Their program will essentially, what they're promising is that the student's out-of-pocket cost is going to be zero. And so that does take into account their Stafford loans. For students from low-income backgrounds, those loans are subsidized, which means they don't gain interest during the years that they're attending college. What's also great about Carthage in particular is they have a four-year graduation promise that they make to their students. And so they really have an excellent path to help students graduate within 4 years. They make that guarantee. And that really keeps costs lower there. So with a lot of private universities, when families consider them, they get sticker shock because the price they see on the website is much higher than what they actually pay. And it's really great to see this trend and to see Carthage being a leader in southeastern Wisconsin to really make their school more affordable and more appealing to students from lower income backgrounds.
Yeah, I'm glad that you talked about the sticker shock, because I'm sure there are some students and families who rule out applying to private colleges because they assume that it's going to be more expensive than public universities.
Absolutely. We encourage our students to look at all their options, both private and public, so that they can, you know, assess what each school is offering. What you often see at private universities is that there is more institutional aid that is offered to students and more foundation support potentially. And a lot of our students will wind up going to private universities, even though the cost on paper might seem a lot higher, but they're offered a lot of aid that makes it competitive, especially for students from lower income backgrounds. the rising cost of college presents more barriers for students from lower income backgrounds. And so that's why we see a degree divide that has happened between students from low income backgrounds and higher income backgrounds. And what we also know is that disproportionately impacts students who are Black, Indigenous, people of color. So I'm personally really excited that this kind of program is going to be offered to our students so that they have more options to consider and that the barriers to higher education are reduced.
Kevin Curley is Senior Program Director at College Possible Milwaukee. He spoke with WUWM's Emily Files. Students who apply to Carthage and the UW system will automatically qualify based on their federal applications for student aid, known as the FAFSA. The FAFSA application window opens October 1st. In about 10 minutes, we'll hear from a member of the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective about the history of Cubans in Milwaukee.
100 to 200 families settled in the Milwaukee area. In fact, like 81 Cubans arrived on a National Airlines charter flight to Mitchell Field in June of 1962.
But first, Doors Open Milwaukee is this coming weekend. We'll learn about some of the old favorites returning to this year's roster and look at a new app-based tour exploring Indigenous spaces throughout the city. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Doors Open has become a beloved annual event here in Milwaukee. For 2 days every year, unique or historic buildings throughout the area open their doors to the public. It's a great chance to see some of the most interesting spaces in Milwaukee and learn about their history. This year, Doors Open is offering some app-based walking tours as well, including a new one this year featuring Indigenous spaces in the city. Julia Griffith is the program director for Historic Milwaukee, and Brian Rindfleisch is an associate professor of history at Marquette, who helped develop the Indigenous Milwaukee Walk and Bike Tour. They join me now to talk about this. Julia, Brian, thank you both so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
So there are a couple of new walking tours that are included in Open Doors this year. That includes I believe it's a walk and bike tour of Indigenous spaces in Milwaukee. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So this year for Doors Open, we're launching 4 new neighborhood walking tours, and 2 of them happen to be related to Indigenous, it's history, present, and future more than anything else, but it's all place-based in Milwaukee. And one of them is kind of a walking tour. You could do any of them with a car or on a bike. And then one is a little bit further distance, so it's geared more towards biking and driving if you're not a biker. But they'll be available on our website and on our app, which is free to download and also free to access as well.
So when you say one is a little bit further out, where are we talking about?
So the biking tour goes all the way from McKinley Park on the lakefront to Forest Home Cemetery to kind of an outlook looking over at the Menominee Valley and American Family Field, and then back to Marquette.
So what are some of these spaces, these areas that are included in this tour?
So the sites were chosen. They're part of a larger, broader project that Marquette is doing that's part of what is called the Indigeneity Lab. And so this Indigeneity Lab is this multidisciplinary, I guess you could call it sort of a think tank, but it's a collaboration between faculty members and undergraduate students who do summer research to work on various projects. And right now we have 4 of those projects, and 2 of them just happen to be about mapping sort of Indigenous Milwaukee with a virtual map. And the outgrowth of that was this tour when Julia and Historic Milwaukee approached me about taking the map and basically creating a biking and walking tour of Milwaukee itself, which I've just been thrilled with. And so a lot of the sites, and the purpose of the whole project, is to just highlight how Indigenous community members in Milwaukee have shaped Milwaukee, you know, not just in the past, but right now, you know, with spaces like the Ignace Health Center, Potawatomi, and all of the philanthropic work that they do, as well as, you know, the future generations that will come out of places like the Indian Community School down in Franklin. So it's really highlighting just Indigenous presence in the city of Milwaukee, because not many people know anything about, you know, Indigenous history in the first place, let alone that we have this very vibrant Indigenous community in Milwaukee, but also tracing that throughout history from the past all the way till now and then for the future.
I think people will be familiar with the idea that Milwaukee was a meeting place for a number of different tribes. How does that translate into the historic places that we visit through this tour?
That's a great question. It reaffirms that idea at the same time that it also turns that idea on its head. So when you visit the lakefront, you know, Lake Michigan, it's going to talk about how, right, Indigenous groups like the Menominee, the Ho-Chunk, and the Potawatomi, the Ojibwa, the Oneida, you name it, all utilize those water spaces. And because Milwaukee is such a water space, right, the entire area of Milwaukee was, as we call it, a gathering place for these peoples and communities and the various activities that they did here. And later on, that includes Europeans, especially the French, in which they established that very vibrant fur trade around here. And later on with the United States in the 19th century, the same thing. But at the same time, you go and visit a place like Juneau Park, right? And we, you know, we talk about Solomon Juneau in our history as being the first mayor and the founder of Milwaukee. Yeah, but he wouldn't have been able to be that person or do the things that he did without his wife, Josette, who was Menominee. And so we spent a lot of time talking about Josette instead of Solomon and talking about the ways in which she allowed Solomon to basically interact with her peoples and become that very celebrated figure. So at the same time, the tour talks about how we need to celebrate Josette as, you know, a founder of Milwaukee in the same space that we talk about Solomon Juneau as that.
When we travel to these different spaces, do we see remnants of this history that, as you say, is both in the past, but also living?
Yeah. So one of the highlights for me is talking about sort of like the very ancient roots of Indigenous communities in Milwaukee, and specifically the Mississippian civilization, which has existed for aeons. We still have several of Mississippian mounds still in Milwaukee. And so Julia highlighted the Forest Home Cemetery is one of the most accessible mounds that you can find in the Milwaukee area. And it's still there. It hasn't been bulldozed in the 19th or 20th century or torn down. It's still there. There's also the Esterbrook Stone, which people just run by and walk by all the time in Esterbrook Park, which is a remnant of the Mississippian civilization and the ways that it demonstrates their food ways, their technologies. It's just fascinating. But it's so just commonplace that no one actually knows what it is. And so we're hoping to basically illustrate to people like, you know, maybe it's not a good idea to walk in this thing, you know, or, you know, this is how important this thing can be, or at least to our understandings of that civilization.
The other thing which I think is really valuable is that the app platform that we use allows us to link to things like historic newspaper articles, YouTube videos of, like, we highlight the Hunting Moon powwow. So we're able to link to some of the things that maybe are event specific or aren't necessarily happening in the moment that you're at the place, but have happened at some point in its history. And we're able to show you through this platform the true experience that maybe you don't get to have every day. So the technology allows us to sort of congregate a lot of that more ethereal material or harder to access material.
Sure. So a way to kind of immerse yourself in the history there.
Very much so. Yeah.
With that in mind, there are so many sites in Milwaukee that people may never get a chance to see otherwise. What are some of the old favorites that people can, you know, visit this time around?
So we have some excellent sites you can visit. One of my favorites is always Jones Island. You can go and check out the water treatment facility. They'll explain how they make mullorganite. It's great for families. New this year, actually, the Fiserv Forum will be open on Saturday, which is very exciting. No ticket required. One of the things I always love is we get so many people who ask for, oh, I would love to go to that church, or Annunciation Greek Orthodox Church on the north side is one. People, it's designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. People always wish to tour, and they're really not open. So they'll be open. They're regularly participating in Doors Open, and that's a great kind of unknown site. And then a favorite of mine is always Alice's Garden, which is a community garden on the north side. The community they built around that garden is just incredible. And you maybe have seen them. They make products that they sell at like farmers markets and the Milwaukee night market from the things that they grow. And so they just, the industry there is quite incredible.
Listeners will be familiar with Alice's Garden from our monthly segment with Venus Williams, who is their executive director. Well, Julia, Brian, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Julia Griffith is the program director of Historic Milwaukee, and Brian Rindfleisch is an associate professor of history at Marquette. Doors Open will be this weekend, Saturday the 24th and Sunday the 25th. You can find a full list of the sites that'll be included in Doors Open at historicmilwaukee.org, where you can also find information about all of their walking and app-based tours. It's Hispanic Heritage Month, which means we're celebrating the histories of Latinx people in Milwaukee. More than 60 years ago, after the rise of the Castro Revolution, Cubans started to immigrate to Milwaukee in larger numbers. Since then, they've become an integral part of our city. From Marta Bianchini, the owner of Cubanitas, to Jose Delgado, who helped create the American Transmission Company, Cuban Milwaukeeans have been influential in our state. Raul Galvan is the manager of program production at Milwaukee PBS, and he's a part of the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective. He joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang to share more about the legacies of Cuban Milwaukeeans.
The Latinx Collective is something that Tess Arenas began. She's a retired administrator, and she had just finished writing a book documenting histories, oral histories of Latino women. And so this is an opportunity to tell new stories, to document the entire history of the Latino population, which has been an integral part of Wisconsin for many years. I'm really excited because, you know, I'm a historian. I also teach at UWM. And I think it's going to be a worthwhile endeavor. All those stories I didn't tell you are going to be housed and curated at the Wisconsin Historical Society of Medicine.
And your main focus, your primary focus, is focusing on the histories of Cubans in Milwaukee. Could you tell us a little bit about the history of Cubans in Milwaukee?
I'd like to think that I'm sort of part of the history of Cubans in Milwaukee. I came in 1975, April, to work at the then Milwaukee Public TV. When I got here, there were scattered number of Cubans. The people that were there then were the remainder of the folks who had come in what is typically called the historic Cuban immigrants that left the island at the very beginning of the revolution. So those folks had come here basically like right in 1961. Some even came before. It's estimated that 100 to 200 families settled in the Milwaukee area. In fact, like 81 Cubans arrived on a National Airlines charter flight to Mitchell Field in June of 1962. Most of these Cubans of the early batch that came were sponsored by churches, either Catholic churches and Catholic family movement groups within those churches or Protestant churches. You know, the early group that came were most white. There were varying degrees of education, and they found jobs at area hospitals, factories, publishing houses, car dealers, and schools. And the thing that also happened in Milwaukee and happened where I grew up in Moline was that as the families got settled, made a little money, spent a couple of winters in the north, they said, man, we got to get out of here. And so they hightailed it back to Miami, where they lived for the rest of their lives. There was a huge influx. I think there were about 14,000 Cubans that came to Fort McCoy in 1980. They were escaping the island in the boat lift, which was referred to as the Mariel boat lift. They were scattered throughout the United States in resettlement camps. There were a lot of folks that came to La Crosse area, Sparta, and 14,000 of them. And those folks, I think it's safe to say, left the state. But some of them stayed in Milwaukee. Some of them stayed in Madison. I remember I spent 3 or 4 days at Fort McCoy with a camera crew working on a documentary. And I was this group was very, very diverse. There were a lot of Afro-Cuban folks. There were a lot of single people. You know, if they ended up at Fort McCoy, it's because they had no one to take them in family-wise.
You mentioned this in your previous answer, but you had talked about how in the early 60s, 80-ish families, people arrived to Mitchell International Airport. Could you talk about that history? Why did they arrive to the Milwaukee Airport?
What was happening, Miami in 1959, 1960, was, believe it or not, a sleepy little town. There was definitely not much industry in Miami. You know, I remember when I arrived in Miami, there weren't any freeways. Miami couldn't support this number of people. Mind you, there were like about 400,000 Cubans that arrived in Miami between 59 and 67, including a group of about 14,000 kids, unaccompanied kids, one of which was me, that arrived at the same time. And so the Miami economy could not support all those people. And so an effort was begun immediately to resettle, to relocate as many of those families as possible, you know, away from Miami. And the church played an instrumental role in getting that to happen. So this group of 81 Cubans that arrived on a charter flight were sponsored by members of the Catholic Church in Milwaukee.
Right at the very beginning, you said that you are a part of the Cubans in Wisconsin and Milwaukee history. How are you documenting the histories of folks for the collective?
I happened to find a treasure trove of documents at the Archdiocesan Archives here in Milwaukee because of the Catholic family movements. And so they've got a number of scrapbooks, and I happen to know a few people who were in that first group of historic Cubans. Robertico Nodal came as a teenager. I think he arrived in Milwaukee in like 64, maybe 63. And so he's been able to put me in touch with some other folks who I've interviewed. In addition to Cubans, I know there's some other folks who aren't Cubans who are Latinos who I haven't heard mentioned in the group that in the sample that folks have spoken about to interview and are incredibly important to Milwaukee Latino history.
Raul Galvan is the manager of program production at Milwaukee PBS, and he's a part of the Wisconsin Latinx History Collective. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang last year. And in case you didn't know, you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast. If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Coming up, we'll tell you about a new exhibit at Latino Arts that looks at the effects of time on memory. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. a new exhibit at Latino Arts looks at the effect of time on memory through the eyes of Guatemalan-American painter Richie Morales. Morales says his paintings reflect how colorful and vibrant living in Latin America can be. They also untangle his experiences seeing his aging grandfather grapple with Alzheimer's. WUWM's Mayon Silver stopped by the exhibit to speak with Morales about his work.
We're seeing here maybe like 20 paintings, and they're all bright, vibrant colors. There's yellows and oranges and reds and blues and greens. Yeah. And I want to ask you about the motifs. But you have like white outlining of objects.
Uh-huh, yeah.
A lot of birds, there's some hearts that I see, the physical human organ.
Yeah.
And there's sometimes some faces and some plants and heads. So how do these motifs or these like objects fit into your paintings? Like what inspires you about them? What do they mean?
Before this, I used to paint very political topics. But my grandfather passed away because he got Alzheimer. So that was something what impacted me very deeply. So I got a little bit obsessed about the memory. So I have to start like digging into the or researching about what's memory and how can I represent memory and what a memory is and how you can access to your memory through sometimes a meal, sometimes an eventuality as a weather or those kind of things. So for me, it's those things together, plus we got COVID, and that it was like very evident that we are very interconnected in different levels. So sometimes as a human beings, we are not aware that we are animals as well. So sometimes because we have conscience, we think we can just do whatever we wanna do with everything, even nature, right? But the nature have a lot of wisdom in it. But we are not putting attention of that. I think the combination of those things are there, plus the weather in the south side of America as a continent, the weather is pretty much spring all over the year, especially in the south part of Mexico, Central America, and part of South America. We don't have like seasons like here. So you can see birds and nature all over the year. So that's very beautiful. And I didn't notice until I moved here to the United States, you know, because we have very cold winter and that impacted me. And I was missing the nature and birds and those kind of things.
So what were some of the ways that your grandfather, what were some of the things that brought his memory back in those later stages when you would interact with him? Did he get inspired by colors and birds and things like that too?
I mean, he was a very cool storyteller. And then passing the time, he was mixing the histories. And that intrigues me because I noticed that his memory was in juxtaposition of another ones. So I was thinking about how of our memories are true or how we create our own memories in basis on different moments in life, right? So for example, we can start eating something and that food take us to a specific moment with our grandfather, grandmother, or something like that. But how much of that memory is the truth? So I noticed he was kind of mixing his memories and crossing the histories, and that impacted me like, oh my God.
So I've noticed that there's a lot of different components to your paintings and almost a lot of different layers. Can you talk about that?
Yes, what I do is, because it's in I'm working in memories, so I was thinking about how I can represent a memory through color or in a physical way. So, and it's very limited, the possibilities we have in a canvas, right? So I start working in layers and then sanding to go until the beginning and see what happens. So you can see the colors juxtapositions as in regular memories we have, right? So in our brain, I think our memories exist in layers. So once you get in one of your memories in the bottom, then you have this other question: how much of truth is in that memory, right? Or how this memory it was impact for another situation. And then you have it and you think, oh, this is the way I remember, but is really true, or is like it have been a little distortion because another event's around? So that's what I use, different layers on top of another layers and on top of another layers, and then I try to go back to the beginning and ask those questions, you know, like, in who is responsible for what happened in the cosmos, the universe, and those kind of things.
It's almost like the color is the imposition of time, mm-hmm. and it's like, how does time wear away or mutate or change those original events that as we remember them?
Yes, exactly right.
And you are a self-taught painter, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Can you tell me how you were drawn to painting in the first place, and like what role it's played for you since you started doing it?
I mean, I grew up in Jocotenango, which is a small like town outside Antigua Guatemala, which is one of the first and main cities in Central America. Actually, Antigua was the first capital of Central America. And yeah, the place where I grew up is full of artists and artisans. So when I start having like the first contact with something like art, it was doing ornaments, fruits made of wood. And I was painting those kind of things. So my first contact with art, it was through work. And then I did another job, so I was very interested in the movement of ink and acrylic on superficies. So, and the possibilities you can experiment through acrylic. How many possibilities you can have with texture and those kind of things. And then the accident of, you know, dropping some paint in the floor and then it gets dry and then what happened, and you know, those kind of things. So then I took a couple of courses with some friends who are professional artists in Guatemala. One is Mario Garcia or Fernando Escamay or Hector Rositan, and those guys showed me another techniques and showed me how to prepare the canvas, because I start from zero with the canvas. So yeah, that's what is my background. So plus I read a lot and I experiment a lot. So I continue doing experiments with, you know, acrylic, which is my medium and is what I love to use. And ink too.
And you've said that we can only heal what we're willing to see. So what to you is the role of art in social justice, or even art in explaining to people what it's like to witness a loved one lose their memory?
I mean, I think we need to start to having more conversation between, because it, to me, it seems like, probably because I can see United States from an external eyes, I see US is very polarized right now. And we need to start to have real conversation with the people think different than us, because otherwise we will continue polarize more and more and more. So through art, we can open those conversations, which are kind of difficult, but at the same time are necessary, right? We need to do it, because otherwise the country will be, I don't know where, but yeah. And I believe, like, the idea of continent, you know, Latin America have a lot of things to offer, and we need to work together. I think will be a very beautiful thing if we achieve something like that.
Beautiful. Well, Richie Morales, thank you so much for your art, and thank you for talking to us at WUWM.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Richie Morales is a Guatemalan-American painter. He spoke to WUWM's Mayan Silver. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at the impending financial woes facing the city of Milwaukee and possible solutions to avoid major cuts to services. Plus, we'll speak with a local business owner about her passion for supporting Latino entrepreneurs in Milwaukee. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.